Please welcome my dear friends, the classic American band, Orleans.
Hi, this is Alan Chartek,
and I am really delighted to be in conversation today with composer, musician, rock and roller with the band Orleans, author and former 19th District Congressman John Hall. From his piano lessons at age 5 to his medal-winning French horn performance at the Ithaca College Music Festival, his folk days of singing Weaver's Peter, Paul, and Mary and Bob Dylan songs, to his obsession with the Ventures, Beach Boys, Beatles, and Jimi Hendrix, John Hall learned three things: to play, write, and listen. Now that he's finished serving two terms as a congressman, John is writing songs again, performing solo with Orleans, and continuing with his environmental activism. And now he's just released a new memoir, available at Amazon.com, titled Still the One, A Rock and Roll Journey to Congress and Back. We'll talk with John Hall about all of this and much more, but welcome, John Hall.
Why, thank you, Alan.
Which did you like more, being congressman or being a musician?
I think I like being a musician more, but I like them both a lot. They're both very exciting, and being in Congress enabled me to see things, learn things, go places, meet people I would never have done otherwise, and I'm very proud and honored to have served for two terms.
So what was the biggest pain involved in being a congressman?
Raising money.
It was.
It's easy. And it's even worse now, because when I lost the election in 2010, which is the only election I lost out of six that I ran in, the others being county legislature and school board, so I went 5-for-6, which is not a bad average. But
no.
Starting in 2010, it was the first election after the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. So in the last 2 weeks, I got creamed with like $5 million of out-of-district, out-of-state money from dark sources that were not disclosed. And that is only worse today by a couple orders of magnitude. So I don't know. It was hard enough for me to raise money the first time around in 2006. I was told you got to raise at least $1 million. And then they said, well, it'd be better if you had $2 million. You know,
and how do you do it?
You got to be kidding.
And how do you do it?
I started by calling my family and calling my friends, my brothers, my cousins.
Were they rich?
You know, but the suggestion that I was given is that if you can't convince them that you're the best person for that particular job, you'll never convince anybody else. So you start kind of practice your pitch on people who are close to you, and you go through your, what at the time was a Rolodex or a phone book, you know, and your contacts, and you you call everybody, and then you start looking to other people to give you pages and pages of other contacts.
And you just spend your money, your time on the phone.
Yeah, and in my case, I actually had a lot of help from my musician friends who did fundraisers for my campaigns. Bonnie Raitt was so generous and did probably half a dozen events for me. David Crosby and Graham Nash did a couple, one of them, a house party. It was really fun and you know, very financially helpful. Jackson Brown did a number of events. Nancy Griffith, John Sebastian, David Sanchez, and Jack DeJohnette, and I don't know. We did events at a Bruce Springsteen concert where we had a reception that Steve Van Zandt came into and had his photograph taken with every one of the 50 people who had paid to come into the reception and talk with everybody and sign things. And, you know, all of my friends from the musical world were so generous, and I really owe them a debt of gratitude, because I could not have raised that kind of money. I don't have Exxon and Mobil, but as I like to joke, I have Jackson and Bonnie.
That's funny. So, of course, we are talking with John Hall, and John, I guess I want to go back and start at the beginning. We know you had your first music lessons when you were very, very young. 5 years old?
As all children should have. When I was on the school board in Saugerties, when I was president of the board, I read a couple of studies that said all kindergartners should have piano lessons because it teaches them fractions. Because it's, if middle C is zero, it's a power of, a power of, a power of going to the right. in a positive sense, being an octave, another octave.
Sure.
And to the left, it's the negative power of power of power of. And when you're looking at a sheet music page, you're looking at a graph of time versus pitch. And it's all 64th notes or 32nd notes or quarter notes or whole notes. And so the kid's learning math. You know, the kid is thinking, jingle all the way, when really it's like 1-3, 1-2-3 in terms of, you know, pitch numbers in the 12-tone scale or the 8-tone scale.
So tell me about your parents. Who were they?
My parents?
Yeah.
My dad was a electrical engineer, PhD, and also a physics and general science and math whiz. His dad was dean of engineering at Brown University. He became the dean of engineering at the University of Rhode Island.
And that's where you were raised?
No, I was raised in Elmira, New York,
Elmira,
where he worked for Westinghouse. Most of his adult life, he worked for Westinghouse, and he would only go to academia when he got tired of the personality fights and the hiring and firing problems and little bits of infighting at Westinghouse. And he would think, if I go back to the university, it'll be all pure as the driven snow.
Yeah, well, we all know about that.
Get there and find out. He always found out it was just as bad there. And his dreams of doing research all the time were overturned. And so he would eventually go back to Westinghouse, or Big W, as they called it.
I once got into a fist fight at New Paltz with a colleague at a faculty meeting.
Oh, that's almost like Congress. Back when I was remembering, I was talking to somebody about, is it more rough and tumble nowadays than it was? And I, you know, I think it's a lot less disrespectful than it was. When I was growing up, I was taught to respect the office of the presidency or the senator or the congress member or whatever. Even if you disagree with their policies, argue with that, but don't make it personal, you know. And maybe that's an antiquated approach now, but I have to remember that Aaron Burr died in a duel on the House floor. You know,
things in the Weehawken plane.
Things have been banned. So let me. Before.
So John Hall, let me go back to your question about your parents. Your mother.
My mom was a school teacher and a very devout Catholic. Who we all, my two brothers and I, grew up Catholic. And she, after the kids were grown up and out of the home, she was the first woman to attend and graduate from a Jesuit seminary in the United States.
Wow.
And got a master's in divinity and a diploma at graduation when all of her male classmates got Roman collars. So she got a dose of feminism at the same time and sexual identity politics. It's really, it's interesting. They hired her back at the same seminary to teach how to preach the gospel to young men who were coming through after her. But she was never able to preach the gospel herself in the church. But she wanted
to. Did that leave you burned to this day?
That's one of the things that left me burned. But she wanted all three of her sons to be priests. And my father wanted all three of his sons to be scientists. And so my older brother was an actuary, probability specialist. And my younger brother was a priest, Jesuit priest, who lived for a time in Rome and taught at Gregorian University there. And as well as at Georgetown and Lemoyne and you know, other Jesuit schools in the United States. And I fell in between. I was the apple that fell somewhere between the trees. And
why? You weren't any part priest, were you?
No, but I was always told that my songs are too preachy.
That's,
not Still the One.
That's
not
funny.
Dance With You. But yeah. if you read through the albums, you'll see songs like It All Comes Back Again from the first album, which has, you know, the last verse is, well, there's a man in a White House selling everyone a used car, and he plays with his prophets, P-H-E-T-S, and dreams that he's a football star. But the dreams rain down fire on the little plastic men. And if you think it doesn't hurt you, you had better think again.
How do you write? I mean, when you write a song like that, do you write with one hand on the steering wheel and one hand on...
I've done that, yeah. Writing on the passenger seat with a pad and a pen and trying to stay in my lane. But I don't advise that. I advise pulling off the road, stopping the car, and then riding, and then driving some more.
But you don't write it formulaic in your pajamas at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I have done writing. Well, a lot of the early songs, like "It All Comes Back Again" and "Dance With Me" and "Still the One," the early Orleans records, I was writing with my ex-wife Johanna Hall, who, you know, she and I wrote all kinds of ways. Sometimes staying up all night and writing. Later, I learned to write when I was living in Nashville. Or commuting to Nashville, I learned to write on appointment. I'd actually learned to do that before writing on demand when I wrote for a Broadway play, Morning, Noon, and Night.
Mm-hmm.
It was ran in 1969 at the Henry Miller Theater on Broadway.
I liked him.
Yeah.
I liked Henry Miller.
Me too. And I wrote a couple off-Broadway plays One of them won an Obie, actually, in 1969. But I quickly moved to writing songs for a band and also play guitar with lots of different people. In Nashville, you learn to show up at 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock in an office with a piano and a guitar and whoever you made a date to write with. And, you know, I wrote songs there on demand. So if you do really well and you click, you can be out for lunch at 1, you know, and the song's done and recorded already in a demo form. And had a number one record with Steve Warner that he sang, of course, and he was the artist. And he wrote the song with me. And Orleans, I, and Larry and Lance got to sing backup harmony on his record, which was a number one country record. So,
and the name was?
You Can Dream of Me. And so, you know, it happens. There are all kinds of ways. You can, you know, some people write long distance and send things back and forth. It's much easier now, of course, with the internet. But there's no standard way that everybody does of writing songs.
Well, actually, I'm just trying to find out about you.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so your mother goes towards her Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Your father is a mathematician.
And physicist.
And were they together?
An electrical engineer, yes.
And they stayed together?
67 years.
Wow, that's great. So how did you get to that piano when you were five?
Well, whose idea
was that?
I started playing the Marines hymn with both hands when I was four.
Wow.
Four and a half, actually.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the left hand, and from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, you know, with the chords and everything.
In other words,
I had figured it out.
Well, also, you had a certain kind of genius. Well,
obviously.
Not everybody has that.
I'm not going to call it genius. I would call it talent. But my parents said, we're getting this boy piano lessons.
Really?
And so by five, I was studying classical piano with a distant aunt who was a private teacher in Elmira, where I was growing up. And the first thing she did was stand me looking out the windows while she played notes and have me name them without looking.
And did you have perfect pitch?
Well, I did when I was done. You know, I mean,
interesting.
It can be learned, you know, especially at a young age.
Not
a lot
by
of things
me.
Can be learned
yeah.
when you're five. You look at the gymnasts on the Olympics and you see when they started doing a training for it. Look at, you know, famous tennis players, when Andre Agassi, you know, whipping one of his relatives or, you know, some college player when he was seven or whatever. This stuff is on the internet that you can find where you see that kind of development at an early age. And music is no different. My perfect pitch was corrupted later by playing the guitar because you could actually tune it so you're playing off key a little bit. And sometimes if I was playing with my brothers, I was quicker for me to tune to them than for them to tune to me. So I would tune to their pitch, and then we'd be somewhere in between 440 and 441. But anyway, it started with lessons on the piano, 11 years of classical piano, 6 years of French horn.
Wait, do you remember how the piano lessons ended? In other words...
Well, they ended with me making things up that were not on the sheet and being chastised by my teacher and told to look at the music.
This is still your distant aunt.
Yeah.
No.
I still have a problem that I want to improvise more than
but was the teacher you busted up with?
My distant aunt,
yes. It was still your distant aunt, right?
Yeah. Okay. And my band teachers when I was in high school.
Right.
Sister Edwina at Notre Dame High School in Elmira, New York, who I'm in her debt as well because she was the one that allowed me to use the band room in between classes and on study halls whenever I used to run up there and play the drums or play the bass or play the tuba or play the piano or whatever.
So she knew she had somebody special.
Well, she was generous with all of her students, and the ones who wanted to, you know, take it more than just reading the music and getting out of the class as quick as they could, she could tell.
And what was her specialty, Sister Edwina?
She was her Sister Mercy in a
but was her
Catholic
specialty? Yeah, but was her specialty? I know she's a nun.
She was conductor.
Was
she was a conductor of the band, the high school band, and she taught individual instruments as well as band. So,
did you ever get wrapped on the knuckles?
I got kind of wrapped on the knuckles for sitting in the back with my French horn and going droo, droo, like hunting hall calls in the middle of some serious piece that we're all, you know, everybody else is trying to read for the music.
So tell me about the French horn. Now that's interesting because I've interviewed a lot of people at the Boston Symphony and other places, and it's generally agreed the French horn may be the most difficult instrument in the orchestra.
It's hard to play when you're marching, I'll say that. You really need to have a stable armature and to have the horn held in a certain way. The oboe would be a parallel, I think, for woodwind. in that it doesn't really take too a lot of moving around.
Well, the oboe, you have to make your own reeds, whereas the French horn, you know, you have that little tiny, tiny mouthpiece.
Well, that's true. You can at least buy a mouthpiece for a French horn, and it'll last a long time. But it was helpful for my wind. I got to the point where I could hold a note for 30 seconds or more at various parts of my range. I actually played fourth horn in our Ithaca College Music Festival quartet, because playing fourth horn was more difficult than playing the first horn part.
Why is that?
Because it was so low that your lips are barely touching the mouthpiece, and they're sort of flapping almost in the air.
Interesting.
And you can't really have any pressure to speak of against your lips with the mouthpiece.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was the only one of the four of us who could do that. So
you began the fourth horn.
I drew the fourth stroke.
Well, you've got the wrong name on your book. Your wonderful book is still The One, A Rock and Roll Journey in Congress and Back by John Hall. But it should have been fourth horn.
Well, maybe I'll change the next, maybe I'll write another one with that title.
Yeah. Okay. So have you ever used the horn in your rock and roll performances?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. The early days of Orleans, I used to bring it out and play it on a couple songs. I might have played it on record once. I can't remember, honestly. I also played pedal steel on record a couple of times on our records, and also on a record by a artist and producer from Nashville named Richard Landis. Well, he wasn't from Nashville at the time.
But pedal steel hard? Is that a hard
pedal? Pedal steel is very hard, and you don't want to be in the house when somebody's learning it. It's one of those things like somebody learning to play violin, where it can be very scratchy and very out of tune and drive you crazy. I learned enough on pedal steel to be able to appreciate the Buddy Emmonses of the world, or the Bruce Boutons, or the great steel players who can make chords you didn't know existed with the pedals and knee levers.
I know a guy, maybe you know him, Winnie Winston, who grew up, migrated to Australia, got very sick and died. But he was really a phenomenal instrumentalist and a friend of the Traums, all those Woodstockians.
I probably
ran across him somewhere.
Yeah, I heard about him, and I could go look up his work.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, let's go back to your development, and you now graduate from Catholic high school. What happens then?
I didn't graduate. I left.
You attended, as they say in the paper.
I skipped two grades in school. I took fourth and fifth in the same grade, and I skipped senior year of high school. So during my three summers after my freshman, sophomore, and junior years in high school, I attended a National Science Foundation program at Assumption College in Worcester, Massachusetts. And then after the third one of them, after my junior year, I skipped senior year, went to Notre Dame University, the big Notre Dame.
So they admitted you?
They did.
Even though you hadn't graduated from high school?
That's correct.
Good for you.
And unfortunately, I didn't at the time get a diploma because the nuns who were, at that time anyway, the nuns who were running Notre Dame High School wouldn't give me a diploma without senior English and religion. And so...
A rule is a rule, John.
A rule is a rule, but I went back later and did a fundraising concert for the school, and the principal came out with an honorary diploma for me. So I'm happy to say I have a high school diploma.
That's funny.
But I just was racing ahead with my scientific studies, and my dad would teach, Fortran or COBOL, computer programming classes back when you had to program a computer if you were a normal person.
When you're as old as I am, you certainly remember
right.
All of that.
Yeah, and I would tag along at, the age of 13 or 14 or whatever I was, and just sit in the back of the room and pick stuff up. And he'd always write equations on the blackboard over the breakfast table, and my two brothers and I would race each other to solve the problem quicker, And so it was always a learning experience, whether he was teaching us to sail, where you have to learn, degrees of a circle for to steer a compass course, or whether you have to experience physics in terms of the boat heeling because the center of effort moves up higher than the ballast places, the righting moment, as they call it, of a boat, or where when you pull the tiller toward you to head off the wind, the center of effort in the sails moves forward of the center of lateral resistance. But we didn't know those words. All we knew was we were experiencing this physical thing that happened when you change the mechanics of water and air.
Who was the sailor in your family?
I'm probably the most serious sailor. My dad was the,
That's where you got it from. He had a boat?
I learned it all from him, and I sailed maybe a little, more ocean sailing than he did. But he taught me, when I was 5 years old, that was my present that I wanted, was to go sailing with my dad and not my brothers, just me and my dad, you know. And it was raining when the day came, and I insisted that was still the present I wanted. And so I went out with my little yellow foul weather gear on and my dad in his big foul weather gear, and we sailed on Cuttyunk Island off the coast of Massachusetts, the last of the Elizabeth Islands off of Cape Cod. Anyway, that's where I learned to sail and later to windsurf. And I did a lot of sailing and raced windsurfers in the Hudson River off Kingston Point with the Hudson River Sailing Board Sailing Club. And I've sailed the last boat that I had. My wife, Melanie, and I took the boat from Kingston, New York, to Key West. And then I went with a crew, including one of the attorneys who was on the Al Gore 2000 recount team, David Boyd, who's partners with David Boyce, who I'm sure you're familiar with, and with my daughter, Sophie, and one of her college friends. She was our translator. She's fluent Portuguese and Spanish speaker. And so we sailed from Key West to Cuba and spent a few days in Cuba on a humanitarian aid mission. This was early 2001 when things were really tightening up in terms of travel to Cuba. It was the first month or two of the George W. Bush administration. Little did I know that I would then, and that was a legal trip, by the way, because we had a letter from the Treasury Department telling us we could go. China and Vietnam were already most favored nation trade status, but Cuba was still being embargoed. Totally crazy.
Unbelievable.
But little did I know that I would come back and get elected to Congress in 2006, write a piece of veterans legislation called the Veterans Claims Modernization Act of 2008 that it would pass unanimously. Every voting green voting yes up on the board in both the Senate and the House of Representatives, and that President George W. Bush would sign it into law and call it good government, unquote.
And what did it do? What did the bill do?
Well, it did 11 different things, and I would name a couple. It created a doorway for survivors to go through either online or with 1-800 telephone number they could call without having to go through all the different press number 2 for this and press 3 for that, and
And these were for, this is for?
Survivors, children, wives, family of a deceased veteran. One of the things that I'm proudest of is that in order to try to reduce the waiting time for veterans to get their benefits for a severe disabling injury, it required the VA to pay from day one when the veteran or their representative presents the medical record at the VA office, wherever it may be in the country, if it's a lost limb, if it's severe TBS, if it's traumatic brain injury, if it's PTSD that is disabling, the payments start from the day that that evidence is presented. Up until then, a veteran was required to go through their entire claim, which could be, a dozen parts. It could be a loss of range of motion in my wrists, and it could be loss of hearing in both ears, and it could be somewhat reduction in sight, one or both eyes, and it could be back problems from lugging a heavy pack back, up and down mountains and carrying things that are super heavy and, by the way, and losing a leg, So then they would come back, especially from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and, the ones that we are currently involved in, and have to go through the waiting process of getting every little bit of this claim adjudicated. And some of them were disputed by the VA, and some of them they had to go back and get a confirming letter from a fellow veteran in their unit or from their commander, their unit, and have a date and have a time and a place, which sometimes you can't remember if you have PTSD,
sure.
Or sometimes your comrades, your fellow soldiers, they were experiencing their own small arms fire, or they, you might have run over a roadside bomb and suffered an amputation or a crippling, disabling injury, and the other guys in the unit are trying to defend themselves and defend you. And so not everybody can remember or write down exactly what happened at what time and what sequence. And so what we want to do is remove that obstacle. We don't send people over to Afghanistan or to any war zone that we in this country deploy men and women in uniform if they're missing a limb, if they're already suffering from PTSD, if they're already a victim of a traumatic brain injury. This doesn't happen.
So what was all of this going on, John Hall? Was it because they didn't want to pay? Were they just cheap? What was going on?
I think that sometimes Congress is cheap.
Yeah.
As right now, for instance, with failure to fork over the money for emergency Zika funding, when there's already an outbreak in Miami. You know, there's already 1,000 new cases in Puerto Rico every week, and an outbreak in a section of Miami that requires aerial spraying of DEET, which is not necessarily a great thing in and of itself. But for Congress to leave on vacation, as they call it, or back to their districts for 7 weeks right now with that and other important things on their plate, it's not just cheap. It's actually irresponsible and shameful. But I was looking from an outsider when I came in, and then after I was elected and was then appointed by then Speaker Nancy Pelosi as chairman of the Subcommittee on Veterans Disabilities and Memorial Affairs. But the Veterans Disabilities was the main thing we had a problem with that needed quick solutions. That was what made me focus on this particular piece of legislation.
Now, how old are you now, John?
I'm 68.
So you remember Vietnam.
I do.
And what
there's a chapter there in this book that starts out with me men standing up against the wall in undress, being inspected by the doctor and the sergeant from the induction center at Hollabird Avenue in Baltimore, which was the one closest to my home. And after I left school, you know, unless they had a musician's deferment, I wasn't going to get one. So, you know, I was called, I showed up, and were it not for a number of physical ailments, surprisingly enough, athlete's foot was probably the worst. I had a really bad case of athlete's foot. And, you know, showering in a communal situation with other soldiers when you need to march after that, it's not a good thing to have somebody spreading a skin disease to other soldiers. And they gave me a 1Y. I also have a rib missing over my heart, and
one
eardrum's been ruptured 10 and 11 times, one and the other.
1Y meaning you're out.
1Y meaning they'll call me back in a year, and if they don't call me back, they'll never call me back.
Well, you're not going to grow that rib in a year.
Well, true, but then on the other hand, I think in Vietnam, a lot of men and some women, it's not as much as, of course, today when women were allowed in combat roles, but there were a lot of people who were sent who were basically cannon fodder. You know, I mean,
sure.
You didn't have to be 100%, you know, gold medal, you know, quality physical specimen to go serve in Vietnam or any of our wars. But I think that I like to think that I served the veterans and that I served my country in a different way by chairing the Subcommittee on Veterans Affairs and by working with the veterans in my district, for whom we recovered in the course of my time in Congress, I believe it was over $3 million in benefits that had been denied to them by the VA that we got reversed. We got the cases reversed and money paid to them. The single biggest one was a Navy veteran named Ken McDonald, who, rest his soul, he's passed away now, but he had two ships sunk out for under him in World War II. And my staff member in Orange County, who was handling veterans issues for our district office, Lisa DiMartino, as her name, was a magic person with had a magic touch with the VA. She brought this fellow, Ken McDonald, to my attention. He had been denied PTSD classification, even though after the second time of having a ship disappear from out from under him and seeing sharks and body parts going by in the dark, floating out of sight of land in the Pacific, he kept trying to save other people from the ship and get them into the lifeboat. His fellow sailors had to hold him back so they could row away twice from the big ship so that the suction of the big ship going down wouldn't pull the lifeboat down with it. And he had a drawer full of medals in his house that he never showed to anybody. He couldn't talk about it when I met him without crying and shaking. He'd never been able to hold a job or, you know, maintain a relationship, let alone a marriage. He was living in his friend's guest room. His friend happened to be the commander of the VFW post in Buchanan, New York, and they came to our office and came to me and said, can you help us? And we got that case reversed to be 100% PTSD classification, $98,000 of back disability pay, and $2,400 a month for the rest of his life, as much as he had.
Now, don't you ever wonder, I've had an experience somewhat like that, helping a guy who had been a veteran, denied an experimental drug. I walked in, I was on TV every night. They made a big fuss about me, and he had already been denied. He walked in, and they immediately denied him. They saw me, and they pulled me in, and said, okay, he can have what he
wants.
Leave
us alone.
Yeah, right. Now, what is extraordinary about that is, think of all the people who didn't go to John Hall who have been screwed by the group.
Well, you know, the VA is made up of some some very good, well-meaning people at the top and probably all throughout, and especially at the bottom, the ones who have contact, the doctors and nurses and so on, who deal directly with the care of our veterans. I think that by and large, you know, the vast majority of them are doing the best job they can. But there's a lot of middle management in that agency. He has an Eddie federal department, and there are people in a lot of those positions who are about turf. They're about their own little sphere of power.
Sure.
And they really don't want to hear about change. And I served with Secretary Shinseki, former Chief of Staff General Eric Shinseki, who graduated from West Point, which I represented when I was in Congress. It's in the district, you know, the former 19th. And Eric Shinseki had a Purple Heart, two Purple Hearts, actually, one of them for a lost foot. He spent a long time, close to a year, I believe, in a VA hospital recuperating from that injury and having a prosthetic foot installed by the VA. And he was really, and I think is, beloved by a lot of veterans, you know, for that and other reasons. He's a soft-spoken man who doesn't speak off the cuff, but when he talks, people listen, and he doesn't shout, you know. But I thought that he would have as good a chance of changing the agency as anybody, and he did affect some changes, and I worked with him when I was there on trying to get things smoothed out so that our veterans did not experience these kinds of roadblocks, which sometimes appear like a private insurance company trying to deny a claim.
Mm.
You know, it should not be that. It shouldn't be veterans' adversary. We like to say it should be a veterans' advocate, and that at least was something our office could do.
So, John Hall, let's go back to the music now.
Oh, good.
And by the way, thank you for what you did for veterans.
You're
I
welcome.
Think that's wonderful. Let's go back to the music and take up the development of your career. So now, tell us how you got into the band, what you did, what happened.
Well, I was playing in bands in Washington, D.C. Actually, Westinghouse moved my dad from Elmira, New York. They closed the plant there and moved his job to Friendship Airport at the time. It was called now BWI in Baltimore. There's what used to be a Westinghouse plant, I think it's been purchased by another company, as happens nowadays more and more. And he was working there, and the family was living in Ellicott City, Maryland, west of town. So I was commuting into Loyola College and attempting to complete my BA by studying, at this point, liberal arts. I'd moved away from physics and, you know, science, and was studying English and, you know, basically a BA track, and also commuting to Georgetown and playing in bands down there and playing whatever gigs I could find with my brother Jim on bass and with a couple other, you know, a drummer and another guitar player who I met and started jamming with. And we found out about a gig in Georgetown. I wound up dropping out of Loyola, and my parents were so concerned about this because they were sure I was throwing my life away, and I could have been. You know, I just really, you know, was lucky to be in the right place at the right time and have a little bit of talent and a lot of self-promotion gene in there in the genetic chain. And I wound up playing on M Street in Georgetown in different clubs, and then a guitar player that I had worked with and bands there, Teddy Spelios, who was 16 at the time, and I was 18 at the time, took a Greyhound bus to New York City, and we heard that the Cafe Wa in Greenwich Village was auditioning bands, and we looked around and found a drummer and another guitar player singer. Barbara Keith was the guitar player and singer, who you probably know. She's from Massachusetts now, and is a terrific songwriter and singer herself, and played a rhythm acoustic guitar in this band that we called Kangaroo, and a drummer named N.D. Smart, Norman D. I don't know what the D stands for, but it stood for Notre Dame, after I went to two Notre Dames. Anyway, he played drums later in the band Mountain with Leslie West, and he was, became a drummer of some renown. But at the time, we auditioned, and we got a job playing at the Café Wa, doing six sets a night or a day. We'd start at 2 in the afternoon, I think, and then go on into the evening. For an underage crowd, it was like many of the basket houses in New York. It was, you know, ice cream and sodas and, you know, potato chips and stuff.
I remember
like that.
Them well.
Yeah, so no alcoholic beverages, but
but expensive.
Yeah, but expensive. It was probably cost more for a milkshake than it did to go around the corner and get a beer. But anyway, we were all, I think, underage at that time anyway, for the beer, that is. So, you know, here we are playing one day, getting ready to start our set. And a guy, you know, shows up in the doorway, ducking under the curtain, coming into this darkened room with blue light and pulsing amoebas on the wall behind us. And you know, kind of 60s light show. And this guy comes in with a big puffy afro and a cape on. And sure enough, it's Jimi Hendrix.
Wow.
And he comes in and sits down in the front row on a bench right in front of our lead guitar player. And we proceed to play our whole set like in his face. Our guitar player, Teddy, had his foot on Jimmy's table. And it's like playing his, he had a very old, invaluable guitar, Fender Broadcaster, serial number 55, the predecessor to the Telecaster. And I was playing a Hofner bass, imitation Hofner bass or something. But we were alternating sets with various other bands at one time. And for a good part of our run at the Cafe Wild, Bruce Springsteen's band, the Castiles. Next door, David Bromberg and the Fugs were playing at the Players Theater. Around the corner at the Night Owl Cafe, John Sebastian and the Loving Spoonful had just left to go on the road with Do You Believe in Magic as a humongous first hit. I think it was their first hit, but they were having a string of hits that was unbelievable. And their replacements at the Night Owl Cafe were the Flying Machine with James Taylor singing lead and playing rhythm guitar, and Danny Korchmar playing electric guitar. My friend Zach Wiesner, whose father was Jerome Wiesner, president of MIT, on bass, and Bishop O'Brien, Joel Bishop O'Brien on drums, and all of whom went on to, well, they all played with Carole King at one point or another, and one of them married her. And interesting enough, Carole and James did, for my 2010 campaign, did a couple of receptions on their tour together. One at the Verizon Center in D.C. and one at Madison Square Garden in New York, where they came around and spoke to everybody, all of my donors who had paid the big bucks to come in early and hear the sound check, which is really interesting for a lot of people who haven't heard a sound check before, and then see the show and hear the show. And they signed autographs and talked to people and shook hands and had pictures taken with them and all. That was, they were very generous with their time and their talent. But anyway, these circles keep coming back. So I played in the Village and then wound up after Kangaroo, did kind of a one record for MGM and an abortive tour that included the MGM convention in Las Vegas and then back to the Cafe Wild again. And we played also opening to the Doors and the Who at the Singer Bowl in the old World's Fair grounds in Queens. Anyway, I wound up becoming a guitar player of some in some demand for recording sessions. I wound up through Johanna, my ex, being introduced to Israel Horovitz. Her dad was a drama critic with the Philadelphia Bulletin and knew everybody in the theater business. And Israel Horovitz was sort of an up-and-coming hot playwright at the time. And he asked me to co-write some songs for his play that became the opening act morning of Morning, Noon, and Night, with Terrence McNally writing Noon and Leonard Melfi writing the third act, Night, and I did background music where it was appropriate and songs where it was appropriate, and played on stage in the band, which was not only an incredible experience to be there for previews and opening night when the curtain goes up on opening night, but also to be able to join the Musicians Union, Local 802 of the AFM, for the first time and getting paid union scale, as opposed to $6 a night and all the ice cream and potato chips that I could eat. I mean, it's a big step up there to be playing on Broadway and being paid through the union. So suddenly I was getting paid not only union scale for recording sessions, but for doing these shows. And then I wound up being picked up by, signed to Columbia Records by Clive Davis, who was the president of the company at the time, famous impresario of many other companies since then. But Harvey Brooks, the bass player from the Electric Flag and the bass player on Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde record, which I and everybody else loved, had just been hired as an A&R man, as a producer by Clive Davis at Columbia. And Harvey signed me and the other two people who walked in his door first. The first three people in the door, I think. Maybe this not that simple. But
I doubt it.
Harvey's a great guy, and he signed me to make a record for Columbia. And we wound up going on his credit cards, which I found out later, charged to my royalty account to California and doing some recording in L.A. I was young, you know, what can I say? And then recording in San Francisco, and we lived in Marin County and recorded in Wally Hyder Studios in San Francisco. And during that time, I got to present the song that Johanna and I had written for Janis Joplin. It's a whole other story how she, as a journalist, met Janis Joplin and how Janis asked us to write a song for her together. But Anyway, I had to teach it to her band at the time, a Full Tilt Boogie Band, which is the last band she had before her unfortunate OD and early, unfortunately, very early death. But anyway, Janis learned the song, loved it, played it from then every show until she passed away, recorded it on the Pearl album. It was the B-side of Me and Bobby McGee. And both the Pearl album and the single of Me and Bobby McGee were instant number ones. Of course, after it's a shame, but this is what happens when a diva like Janis or Whitney Houston, or when, you know, somebody like, you know, Prince, or, you know, there have been too many people who've died of various reasons, but on, you know, too many of them from drug and or alcohol. I include the alcohol with that. Abuse or overdoses.
I want to stop you for 1 minute and remind everybody you're listening to John Hall, and his new book is Still the One, A Rock and Roll Journey to Congress and Back. Great picture of you on the front cover, John.
Thank you.
Okay, so now how do you get to Orleans?
Well, so Janis, you know, recorded the song. I get a little bit more in demand because all of a sudden everybody knows that song.
Yeah.
And they look at the credits and they see John Hall and they wonder who he is, and they find me elsewhere, among other places, on the Seals and Crofts Down Home record, which I played lead guitar all over and had a great time. On Taj Mahal's The Real Thing, double live album, mm-hmm. The Fillmore East and Fillmore West. Taj asked me, through John Simon, keyboard player and producer and artist himself, to play in that band with the four tubas, Howard Johnson and his other three tuba cohorts. And then after that, I went to Europe and I was playing with Karen Dalton, the late Karen Dalton, who was managed by Michael Lang of the Woodstock Festival, whose record label, Just Sunshine, she had recorded for and I had played on. So I went to Europe to open to Santana with Karen Dalton on a tour that was supposed to include the entire continent. And we were opening a show to this powerful, very popular already, Santana. And Karen was kind of a wispy-voiced combination between Tim Hardin and Billie Holiday, I would describe her. And we had in the band Denny Sywell, who played drums later in Wings with Paul McCartney. We had the late Bill Keith, who was a steel guitar and banjo, especially legend, who I was a fan of, and me and, you know, other notable musicians. And we got to, we played a bunch of gigs in France and in Germany, and then we get to Montreux, Switzerland, and Karen doesn't get a sound check for the 10th time or 12th time in a row. And it's in her contract. She insisted that she get a sound check. But the unfortunate reality, you know, if you're the opening act, is that you usually don't get a sound check. I mean, it all depends on how much muscle you have or your manager has. But at the time, she didn't have enough to get a sound check, and she stomped out of the casino in Montreux, Switzerland, and refused to perform. And the promoter came downstairs to the dressing room where we were all getting ready and tuning up and getting on our good T-shirt to go on stage or whatever it is, and said, somebody's got to do a set. I've got 6,000 people out here, you know, waiting for a show. There will be a riot. You know, neither Santana at that show, Buddy Miles was on the second act on. He was a special guest. Neither Buddy Miles nor Santana are here and ready to perform. So somebody could, and so I said, I'll do it. And I took my Strat and my little tweed Princeton amp and put it on a stool in front of a microphone going through Santana's huge sound system. And Bill Keith backed me up on bass. And our rhythm guitar player, Danny Hankin from Kansas, I believe it was, backed me up on rhythm guitar. And we did a bunch of Jimmy Reed blues songs, and we did a Ray Charles song, Feel So Bad, and just like a ball game on a rainy day. And we closed, after all these sort of blues and R&B tunes that I was covering, with Lowell George's song, Don't Bogart That Joint, My Friend.
1, 2, 3, do you get my point? 5, 6, 7, 8, don't bogart that joint.
And the crowd went nuts and sang along with it. But they'd all seen the movie Easy Rider, and that song was in the soundtrack. So unknowingly, I had done the strongest possible song last, and I went, whew, I got away with that one. Got my guitar and waved goodbye to the crowd and went backstage. And I was on the stairs, going downstairs. The promoter came running after me saying, you have to do an encore. Yeah. One more. Come on. And people were stomping their feet and holding up their lighters and cheering. And so I went back out and I did, you know, I think it was probably Rufus Thomas's song, The Breakdown.
Baby, I've been told, you know how
which is one of the things I like to jam on at the time, with no drums, with a bass player, Bill, and with an acoustic rhythm guitar player, Danny, and me singing and playing through my little teeny amp. And, you know, they loved that too, but the Santana's crew turned the lights up and turned the sound off and ran, you know, played some other music through the speakers to calm them down and get everybody out to the vestibule so they could buy refreshments and buy Santana CDs or whatever. And I went backstage and went, wow, what just happened? You know, on no notice, I got out there and did a set that people loved. It wasn't my songs, but I had to call off songs that the other two guys I was playing wouldn't know, you know, or the chord progressions that would be easy enough to play, you know, three-chord blues songs or two-chord funk songs. And I flew home, even though Karen was cut off the tour at that point. I flew home thinking, I got to start my own band and do, at that point, I've been writing quite a few songs, and I just thought, how much fun would it be to find a band of really great musicians and do original songs and not be a sideman going out with the next person who needs a guitar player, which there always are people who need a guitar player. And I could have done that as a career, but instead I wanted to do my own songs. And so I came back to Woodstock, where we were living in Saugerties at the time, the Lower East Side of Woodstock, as I like to call it. And it's not like that anymore since the Hits Ground moved in and Total Tennis and the other attractions that have come to Saugerties. It's a much different town than it was when we first lived there. But I played with different people at the Cafe Espresso every week. I was playing the John Hall Band, and I was playing with different people. In December, it was Roy Markowitz on drums and Buffalo Gelber and Bill Gelber on bass. And we went down and did a gig at the Cellar Door on M Street in Georgetown, opening to, I think it was, Eddie Harris, a jazz players who did Compared to What, among other things. By the way, Wells Kelly had come back, the drummer, the original drummer who from Orleans, who I had played with at a jam session a couple of years before, and I'd done sessions with. He played on my solo album, Action, which came out of that contract with Columbia Records and Clive Davis. But he came back from Europe from a band over there, and I called him in Ithaca, where he lived with his parents. Father was dean of architecture at Cornell, actually. And I said, Wells, I need you to come down and play with my band. And he said, on one condition only. And I said, what's that? He said, I'll play piano. And I said, well, okay, come on down. And so we had Roy Markowitz on drums and Wells on Fender Rhodes piano and Bill Gelber on bass. And we played at the Cellar Door and we got an encore opening to Les McCann. And so we did the breakdown, Rufus Thomas' breakdown for the encore. And I turned to our drummer, Roy, and I said, would you let Wells play drums for one song? And so he handed his sticks to Wells, and Wells moved behind the drums and adjusted a few things. And then I counted the song off, and we played the funkiest, drivingest version of the breakdown that, until that point, I had ever heard. And months of drum ideas came out of Wells in one song. And the crowd went nuts, and we went back upstairs, and Roy Markowitz, our drummer, quit. He came up to me and said, John, I can't sit back there in good conscience with Wells playing piano when he's obviously a better drummer for your music and what you're trying to do than I am. I can go back and work in the studios in New York. You should be playing with Wells as your drummer. So Bill Gelber, the bass player's girlfriend at the same time, said, I don't want you going on the road anymore, so Bill quit. The bass player quit. Wells and I are sitting in our basement in Saugerties looking at each other going, now what? And he said, I know this guy from Ithaca, Larry Hoppen, who sings great, plays great guitar, piano, bass, any instrument, and why don't I call him? And I said, great, go ahead and do it. So that was the core. Larry came down to Woodstock, and Larry and Wells and I played as Orleans for 9 months. And then when Larry's younger brother Lance, graduated from high school, we auditioned him on bass, and he became the fourth member of the band that recorded Dance With Me, and later with Jerry Murata, still the one.
Dance with me, I want to be your partner, can't you see? The music is just starting, night is calling, and I am falling. Dance with me. Fantasy could never be so killing, I feel free.
Things then really took off.
Things really took off, and it took off so much that
you
went
from being good to being world famous.
We went from being world famous, but only for those two songs initially.
Mm-hmm.
Our fans knew us as a club band, as a dance band, as a jam band, you know, as a band that would try anything on stage. But after Dance With and Still the One were hit, and we toured with Melissa Manchester first, and then with Jackson Browne, who I dearly love, and his music I dearly love, But people knew us more for these pop tunes than for the jamming. It was sort of a little bit of a miscast band in some minds. At any rate, we didn't stay together. I didn't stay with the band, and it's in some ways really a shame that I didn't, although things would not have turned out the way they did. We'll never know. Would it have been better or worse? But there's a chapter in here about how bands break up and how they should all be done in therapy.
The new book, Still the One, by John Hall, A Rock and Roll Journey to Congress and Back. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I got into solo work. I got into environmental benefits. I was fighting to stop the cement and Greene County nuclear plant from being built. I was later fighting to stop the Winston Farm and Saugerties from being turned into a giant dump and incinerator, successfully beating both of those projects down with organizations that I joined or helped to form that were of an environmental bent. You know, and the next thing I knew, Three Mile Island happened and wound up starting Musicians United for Safe Energy with Bonnie Raitt, Graham Nash, and Jackson Brown as my co-founders of that group, getting more involved in politics via the environmental stuff, and then being asked to run first for county legislature, then for school board, and then years later in 2006, when I moved to the other side of the river, back from Nashville to Dover Plains, New York, Melanie and I at that time had been married and for some time, and I met her in Nashville. We moved back here and we're living in Dover Plains, and I learned who my congresswoman was and that I basically disagreed with her on pretty much everything. And I went looking for a candidate to support in the primary or in the general election against her, and met with the candidates who were running in the Democratic primary, and wound up after having lunch or coffee with all of them thinking that I actually had a better chance than they did.
And was your fame as Orland's helpful?
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, it's interesting because people have always underestimated me in elections until Citizens United, that is, of course. But because people would think a guitar-playing tree-hugger environmentalist, what does he know? When, in fact, I read multi-papers or websites now a day and stay up with the news, and I know a little bit about, you know, the issues from things that my parents taught me, and also have this evangelist zeal that my mother imbued in all of us, her children. And, you know, whether it's musical or whether it's working with veterans or whether it's running for office, I don't do anything halfway. So I wound up winning the seat to Congress, to the House of Representatives in the 2006 congressional election, and served two terms there. And then, you know, lost in 2010 and came back as a friend of mine who had served in Congress suggested. I wound up at home looking in the mirror each morning and saying, good morning, staff. I've been used to having 18 staff plus four interns, you know, so I had to learn to drive myself around again and to make my own appointments and keep them, which is not easy when there's no road manager giving you a wake-up call or no scheduler saying, John, remember you got an 8:30 with so-and-so, you know. And so back to what for me is normal life, which is writing songs and playing music.
Well, that's really wonderful. Again, I want to remind everybody that John's new book is Still the One, A Rock and Roll Journey to Congress and Back by John Hall.
And it is available on createspace.com, amazon.com. And if you want a personalized copy of it, you can go to Oblong Books and Records in either Milliken or Rhinebeck, New York.
Great store. We're friends.
And I've worked with them before when they were carrying a CD of mine that had just been released, and we did an in-store performance and signing and so on. So we'll hope to do the same thing with the book. And if you can't make it to Oblong and you don't want to order it from them, if you want a discount on it, you can go to, if you're on Facebook, go to Facebook.com/@johnhall.memoir.
John Hall, you were an early fan of the Weavers.
Oh, yes.
And I take it of Pete Seeger. How important were they to you?
Well, I listened to Pete's little boxes and other records that he recorded with the Weavers when I was a kid kneeling in front of my grandmother's wooden RCA radio in her house in Providence, Rhode Island. And then later I took Johannes and my daughter Sophie, to, when she was a kindergartner, I would take her to the pumpkin sales that the Clearwater did and learn about the life in the river, the aquatic life, and the ecosystem that supports it. And later I was honored to have Pete campaigning for me when I ran for Congress, and then I was his representative. And there's a chapter in here about me and my mom and Pete Seeger and now Senator, formerly at the time Congressman, Ed Markey of Massachusetts, having lunch in the Capitol dining room together. It's kind of a Fellini-esque picture to me, wow, that this particular combination. But my mom never met anybody she couldn't talk to. And Pete could talk to anybody. Yeah. And Ed Markey's a good politician. He certainly knows how to talk. But we all listened to each other, too, at the same time. It was funny that, you know, I said something to Ed about people were already asking me to run for political office. And I said, what do you think? And he said, don't do it. You're reaching way more people than I could just by writing songs with political lyrics.
You know? Interesting.
And then he said, Ed Markey said, you know, sometimes I think he was joking. He said, sometimes I think I'd like to be Dan Rather, that kind of news person who can present the news that I think really needs, or within the way that I think it should be presented. I said, don't do it. We need you where you are.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting day. That was following a rally I organized to try to stop the MX missile from being built, which unfortunately got voted through and built, even though it had failed all of its tests up until that point. And we hope never to find out if it works.
I want to ask you one last question, and that is, we now have this guy, Donald Trump, running for president, and a lot of the country supports him. Does it scare the hell out of you?
Well, yes. You know, I too am an entertainer who moved into politics. But there's a little difference between me and Donald Trump. I did school board meetings. First, I had to run for election. In the school board, you don't run as a member of a party. You run as an individual. And that's the purest form, I think, of democracy. And more people should attend the meetings and, like, see what those people actually do for you and your children. But I would leave my family at the dinner table, gobble a couple of gulps, and then run out to the car to drive to the 8 p.m. meeting at the Ulster County office building and be there past midnight for no money. Well, I think we were getting $600 a month, you know, virtually no money. Not enough for Donald Trump to think about doing anything like that. And then I served later at the county level, and I learned something about how to compromise and how to make deals and what the real process is and where the center of the body politic lies in that jurisdiction. And it served me well later in Congress. Is you don't get anything done by having a my way or the highway approach, an absolutist approach. It's all about how and when and what to compromise on. But there is compromise, or else you end up with the gridlock we have now.
Well, John Hall, we thank you so much for joining us and for this extraordinary tour. But we didn't get enough. If you want more about John Hall, I want you to get the book, because it explains the whole thing, and it is really a remarkable story. You don't see it very much, and we saw it here, and you heard it here. So, folks, John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mel.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.